This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Former McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen will be behind bars and away from his family for a year and a day for the crime of fraud.
The judge said he was torn by Sorensen's two conflicting patterns of conduct, his role in the years-long billing scheme and his community service. He said white-collar crimes like this are typically pure-choice crimes.
GLT's Ryan Dunham was in the federal courtroom in Chicago. Plus, the inspirational power of Batman sparks a movie at the Normal Theater. Laura Kennedy urges you to just say it, "I'm Batman." And the Pages and Paws program. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 618 days after learning of his indictment in a billing fraud scheme, former McLean County Board Chair Matt Sorensen faced the music. In a federal courtroom on the 18th floor of a Chicago high-rise, Sorensen was sentenced for his role in a billing fraud scheme that targeted his former employer, State Farm Insurance. GLT's Ryan Dunham was in the courtroom and is here to unpack the case and the sentence.
So first, a little background on the case itself. So Matt Sorensen was working as an internal consultant at State Farm, and he and a co-defendant, Navdeep Arora, were accused of basically coming up with a phony billing scheme to defraud State Farm out of hundreds of thousands of dollars over a period of several years. Sorensen had already pleaded guilty to a one count of wire fraud in the case back when he was indicted last year. So in court yesterday, he and his lawyer were making the case for leniency to the judge. Ultimately, he was sentenced to a year and a day in federal prison, plus paying a portion of almost $500,000 in restitution to a consulting firm called McKinsey, as well as he received a year of supervised release, basically parole, after he's out of prison.
How did he try to make the case for leniency? What did Sorensen and his lawyer say?
Well, Sorensen and his lawyer tried two, three, four different strategies in court yesterday during the sentencing hearing. Matt Sorensen addressed the judge and actually started by blaming his co-defendant in the case. That's Navdeep Arora. He talked about how they had a very deep friendship dating back to the 1990s, and Sorensen was attracted to Arora because he was successful at his job. Arora worked for this McKinsey consulting firm. It's the largest consulting firm in the world. It was doing business with State Farm. Sorensen and he struck up a friendship that was a long-lasting friendship. But Sorensen said that Arora lied to him and said Arora lied about having a child who had cystic fibrosis and lied about coming from an orphan background and had this kind of sob story that endeared him to Sorensen. And Sorensen took a liking to him and they built that friendship. Well, that was apparently based on lies. Regardless, Sorensen ultimately admitted guilt. He told the judge he was ashamed of himself and asked for mercy. He said he's been kind of living in exile for the past year and a half since the indictment, doing a little work for a couple of companies to make a few bucks, but ultimately in exile. Meanwhile, his lawyer also spoke to the judge and made the argument that this was not a sophisticated enough scheme to warrant this, kind of a steeper sentence in the case, basically saying it was a simpler scheme and thus worthy of a lesser prison sentence. The judge ultimately rejected that.
Did the judge buy the "I was hoodwinked into this"? I mean, this is a man who's at the top of the political spectrum in McLean County, a man who is used to judging the motives of others and their perspectives, and yet he was hoodwinked by this guy?
Yeah, it gets to that question of motive, and what do we know about motive? The judge was very conflicted on trying to resolve this two totally different patterns of conduct in Sorensen's life, right? So Sorensen has a very established track record of community service and government work. at the same time, he's apparently involved with this fraud scheme at State Farm. The judge talked about how white-collar crimes like this are, you know, pure choice crimes. There's not a, you know, Sorensen didn't have any obvious financial hardship or health problems or drug addiction or anything that would have led to that obvious, oh, there you go, moment where you kind of figure out, oh, that's why he did it. Sorensen, again, he blamed his co-defendant, said he was duped into this deep, loyal friendship. And in court yesterday, Sorensen said, quote, he offered me a mechanism to add to my income, and I took it. Another wrinkle in the case is that the prosecution said Sorensen was already making $150,000 legally through his State Farm paycheck. And just for your knowledge, the median household income here in McLean County is like $62,000. So obviously he was making more than the average person already.
Let's clarify, what did he actually do? What was his piece of it? What was the crime?
So Sorensen was in charge of basically supervising outside consultants at State Farm. He himself was an internal consultant at State Farm. Together with his co-defendant, Navdeep Arora, they basically billed State Farm for consulting work that never actually took place. Prosecutors say that Sorensen actually created like a shell company called Gabriel Solutions that didn't really do anything else other than file these fake bills. His defense sort of contests that point about the shell company, but regardless, that was a part of his sentence yesterday.
Gabriel Solutions. Gabriel, blow your horn. There's some irony in that.
There was some reference to it being connected to the two co-defendants' names in some way, but I didn't really fully understand it.
For listeners who've only recently moved to town or don't remember who Matt Sorensen is, we've alluded to it, but let's fill in his backstory here.
Yeah, so this is really like the final chapter of a pretty stunning fall for one of the more prominent politicians in our community. Sorensen was appointed to the county board back in 1992 when he was just 27 years old. He became chair of the county board in 2007. He actually even flirted with runs for higher office. He was under consideration for the state Senate seat that was held by Dan Rutherford when Rutherford went over to the treasurer's office. So Sorensen, when he was on the county board, he helped create the Criminal Justice Coordination Council. He played a role in some of these mental health initiatives you maybe heard about here in the county. He also served on the boards for the Chamber of Commerce, the Economic Development Council, McLean County Historical Society. The judge, Roberto Guzman, actually noted his extensive community service during the sentencing hearing yesterday, at one point stopping the defense attorney and saying, yeah, I'm aware of this impressive list. And he said, quote, frankly, it's the most impressive list I've ever seen in terms of a defendant in front of him trying to make the case that his community service should buy him a little leniency. Regardless, when he was indicted back in January of 2016, it was a very stunning moment for the Bloomington Normal community to see someone of his prominence in legal trouble.
How much money are we talking about?
Prosecutors say he gleaned around $370,000 from the scheme over a period of 3 years. And actually, there was sort of an interesting fight over this restitution issue yesterday in court. In court, there was a representative from State Farm named Tom Fredberg who addressed the judge during the hearing. State Farm supported the prosecutor's request for prison time, but State Farm said that the investigation into the scheme itself internally cost the company nearly $2 million, and they wanted to be paid back for that too, not just the money that was stolen through the billing fraud scheme. The State Farm said that their investigation internally was really the catalyst for the criminal investigation, that they uncovered stuff that the criminal investigators wouldn't have uncovered. Ultimately, the prosecution, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Northern District, did not support their request to get reimbursed for all that money that they spent in the investigation. McKinsey has already reimbursed State Farm for that $500,000 that was lost. So that $500,000 in restitution that we're talking about from Sorensen and his co-defendant is actually going to get back to McKinsey, ultimately.
What do State Farm and McKinsey say?
So a State Farm spokesperson issued a statement yesterday to me that said they're pleased to see closure brought to these issues. Obviously, Sorensen does not work there anymore. McKinsey, which is the largest consulting firm in the world, they issued a statement as well. It talked about how they discovered the scheme in 2011, fired its employee, which is Mr. Arora, and said, quote, we demand the highest standards of professional conduct from our colleagues, and we will always do what is necessary to uphold our values and protect our clients.
What was the scene in the courtroom?
Sorensen had about a dozen family and friends there in the courtroom. I heard a little bit of crying as different things unfolded throughout the court throughout the proceedings. They actually almost missed the hearing itself. There was a last-minute rescheduling, so the whole thing almost went on without anybody in the gallery. Sorensen himself was fidgety throughout a part of a hearing. He was standing right in front of the judge, and yeah, he did look a little fidgety, but he didn't get overly emotional during the hearing. There's no crying or anything like that. He made a pretty strong statement to the judge about his conduct. And again, the only other folks there in the courtroom was the representative from State Farm and a couple of reporters.
When does he report to prison?
He's due to report on November 27th. I exchanged emails with his attorney last night. They don't know where yet he'll be going. His co-defendant in the case, Navdeep Arora, is due to be sentenced on October 18th.
Then what?
Well, it's unclear what Sorensen will do next. He had a pretty strong statement to the judge yesterday. He said, quote, "I have more good work to do in this life, and I'd like to get to it," making the case for the sooner he can get out of prison, the sooner he can resume that good work. But you know, first, he'll be on supervised release for a year. He'll have to pay his portion of the restitution. And his lawyer in this email last night declined to make a statement about what's next for him beyond that.
His avenues for public service are much narrower than they were before this. I mean, he won't be able to engage in the kinds of contributions that he did before.
Certainly, certainly. And, you know, we wonder, obviously, will he stay in the community and what kind of role he'll have? And we'll just kind of have to wait and see what comes next.
Did they say anything about the impact of the family of his fall? Did that come into a proffer to the judge at all?
No, they didn't really speak to the impact on the family. The judge acknowledged that he was a good family man, and that, you know, was kind of factoring into things. His wife was seated with him at the defense table yesterday, and, you know, was seen shaking her head a few times as the prosecution made allegations about the relationship between Sorensen and Mr. Arora, but didn't spend a lot of time getting into the family and the impact on the family.
That's digital content director Ryan Denham of GLT, who was at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse in Chicago yesterday for the sentencing of former McLean County Board Chair Matt Sorensen. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
For GLT comes from the Advocate Charitable Foundation, which provides financial resources for Advocate Broman Medical Center to expand access to health care, enhance patient experiences, enable innovation, and improve health outcomes. Information at advocategiving.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, an interview with the new volleyball coach at Illinois State University. The inspirational power of Batman is at the heart of a documentary running tomorrow night at the Normal Theater at 7 o'clock. It's called Legends of the Night, sponsored by the ISU Department of Psychology. The film features Dr. Travis Langley, who, in addition to appearing in the documentary, is the author of and editor of several well-received books that examine psychological issues through the prism of popular culture. Langley appears at ISU to give a series of talks on campus, plus he'll be part of a panel discussion that follows a screening of the documentary. Laura Kennedy spoke with Langley about psychology and pop culture and its rise in academia.
The worlds of psychology and popular culture converge in the works of Travis Langley, a professor at Henderson State University and author and editor of a popular series of books that utilize popular culture such as Batman, Star Trek, and Game of Thrones as a way to explore a wide range of human behavior and delve into the mysteries of the mind. But long before he was a professor of psychology and a writer, Langley was a budding geek.
Yeah, I was born a nerdy child. No, seriously, in my baby book, it shows that Batman was one of my earliest words. We've got this wonderful photo of me at age 9 months holding one of my mom's comic books and just looking delighted by it. My wife actually tracked down a copy of that specific issue, so now I have that same issue that would have been the one that I was holding in that photo.
Let's talk about the fact that you use pop culture, and particularly superheroes, and you use this as sort of a base in order to teach. And I'm wondering, how did this start for you? Was this something that you saw a gap in the academic world and you said, I got to fill this?
A lot of things came together to me one summer 10 years ago. I was teaching a psychology and literature course that summer, and what I found was that students were really, they were having fun with the material. We're going in classic literature and analyzing characters, Hamlet and others, and they were having fun with the material and learning the psychology really well. And it was a powerful thing using these fictional examples for them to learn about the psychology of real people. And I attended my first San Diego Comic-Con that summer, and this was in my mind. I spoke with comic scholars, and I was thinking about the fact that very little had been written in psychology in the previous 50 years related to comics and superheroes. And so these and some other things all came together for me that summer. So it used to be the nerdy side of my life and the professor side of my life were two different things, and that's when I knew these must be the same thing. I need to write an article about Batman. Within a year, I had so many thoughts, I got to write a book about Batman. And over the course of time, you've been using these things to teach. Sometimes, and English professors, they know this. They get this very easily. Fiction has to be truer to human nature to convince the audience and can get to the essence of what's going on and, you know, the key points in the story. And you can often take a harder look at real life through a fictional example because you step aside from your own predispositions. You step aside from the feelings those might evoke. Star Trek in the 60s, Star Trek was able to explore real-world issues in ways that nobody else on TV was doing because they would talk about the civil rights issues, but through fictional species. In the stories that I use when I'm talking with these students or audiences, you know, I'm using examples. I can't assume anybody knows the same examples I do, but it's still meaningful in a different way. When I teach forensic psychology, the psychology of crime, some of those topics can be so unpleasant and so disturbing that the people I'm talking to miss the point I'm getting at. I can talk about the same things we know from real crime victims, but through a fictional example like Batman as a child seeing his parents murdered, and they stay with me through what I'm talking about.
Ever dance with the devil by the pale moonlight.
Travis, have you experienced any sort of academic pushback from purists who think that maybe this isn't the way that things should be taught in an academic environment?
Not really. One thing is that at the university I'm at, Henderson State University, they're very supportive of creative ways of teaching. They trust us to know what we're doing. A couple of years ago, there was a documentary filmmaker who came here to campus, and he recorded me in the classroom. This was for a documentary called Legends of the Night, using Batman as an inspiration in people's lives. And he wanted to talk to my chair, and he did. He wanted to talk to the dean and get her thoughts on why this was a good way to teach. And I was telling her that he wanted to talk to her, and she said, I have no idea why, you know, using that is a good way to teach, but I trust you to know what you're doing.
Since you're focusing on popular culture and talking about everything from Batman to The Walking Dead, are we using pop culture now in a way that we used to use the classic myths and legends? Are we using pop culture in a general way to learn about what it means to be human now?
Often, yes. Now, of course, people are doing it very deliberately sometimes. They deliberately take these things, and sometimes it becomes kind of artificial. With Star Wars, George Lucas had trouble finishing his original story until he discovered the works of Joseph Campbell, and through Campbell, the approach of Carl Jung, the archetypes and the hero's journey. And Lucas saw these things, and it resonated with him. And he said, this is it. This is the kind of story I'm telling. So he deliberately modeled Star Wars after those, you know, basic tropes, those ancient themes, instead of him being yet another person who was naturally telling that kind of a story. So once we've analyzed it, we've had this time of analyzing it, it's central to physics itself. The thing being studied is affected by the process of studying it.
With the recent rise in superhero films, Travis, do you think that we have some kind of psychological need to connect with heroism? Is there something missing in our own lives? What are we searching for? Is there something missing in us that we're looking for in these films?
Well, we've always needed heroes. And sometimes it's very difficult in the modern age to see where we can find our heroes. In this age of instant communication, once anybody's called a hero in the news, people are going to go picking that person's life apart, and they will find some stupid thing they did in their life, some dumb remark they made once upon a time, or something a relative did. They will pick apart their lives, and it is hard, you know, to have these heroes in this day and age, and yet we still have the same needs. We need heroes. We need somebody to step up and do the right thing. After 9/11, people were talking about, where do we find our heroes? That need was there much as ever. And I don't think CGI is the only reason the big boom in superheroes came after 9/11.
All right, to build on that a little bit, as you say, when we see heroes in real life and then we start to find out something about their past that we didn't like, or they tweeted something that we didn't like or what have you, do we also have this need to tear them down once we have them established in real life? Is there something in us that prompts us to do that?
There can be. There's not a simple explanation on that, though. You know, people have a need to be part of the story. People have a need to feel power over the world around them. And it is often so much easier to destroy than to create. It's easier to get attention by destroying than creating. You could feel good and say, you know, I'm the person who helped everybody find out about how great this person is. All right, but it doesn't get people's attention the same way. I'm the person who found out this person's dirty secret. There's this negativity bias that we have. We pay more attention to things that are unpleasant or negative. They become more memorable. They have more influence over us. Like when you're interviewing somebody for a job and they name all these different wonderful qualifications, but the negative thing about them is what really stands in your mind. And like, there are a lot of reasons for these things.
You are on Twitter, and you're in fact one of the 10 most popular psychologists on Twitter. You've got 100,000 followers, and that's a lot of power. How does that make you feel, knowing that you've got all these people following you? Do you feel like you have to watch every step that you make, that you have to be very careful with every tweet? Because in a way, that is a kind of a sort of superpower.
Well, I think a whole lot of those people are probably folks who, you know, haven't been on Twitter in 3 years or more, you know, because they do have that turnover. And then some of them are going to be spam bots and all that. So, you know, there might be, hey, maybe out of those 119,000 people, you know, maybe 9,000 of them are real. Who knows?
You're very modest.
You know what? But you know what? If there are 9,000 really good ones, that's still a lot of people. Even that, mm-hmm. It's, you know, the town I went to high school in, the population was 5,000. So right there, that right there is double them. But no matter what it is, you know, if it's 20 people you're engaged with, that's cool and interesting. And that's also 20 people who can tell the world that you said something dumb online. So I am conscious about. I'm more conscious about other people who are affected by things I might say or do, who I'm representing. Like, I will almost completely stay out of politics on Twitter and my public Facebook, you know, not just because of me, but because of other people, my students, my university. You know, my opinions do not represent my university. Of course, as a private citizen, I've got the freedom to talk politics, but also the writers who are contributing chapters to a number of these books. I mean, I'm the sole author, the only author of Batman and Psychology, Dark and Stormy Night, but after its success, I got to know other nerdy psychologists, and they joined me. I'm also representing them. I'm also out there, you know, speaking for them, and I'm speaking for this whole approach to psychology. And if my political views or my religious views or something else, you know, crept in, it can distract people from the point that I'm trying to do, the things I'm trying to do to show people is like, we can have fun and interesting lives and do good things in people's lives. We can find heroes in us all. You know, I mean, one thing that recurs through all these things I'm looking at, whether it be Batman, The Walking Dead, Star Wars, Game of Thrones, is what does it take for somebody to be heroic in their life? And to show people that psychology is fun and interesting. And to me, those are the most important things I'm doing. So, yeah, I am conscious about, you know, how the other things that I do or say can take away from that, because something like Twitter is one of the main ways that I get the word out outside the books themselves.
That's Dr. Travis Langley, author of Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night. He's appearing tomorrow night at the Normal Theater in a panel discussion following a free screening of Legends of the Night. Coming out this fall is the newest book that Langley is editing concerning psychology and popular culture. Supernatural Psychology, Roads Less Traveled, will be out later this autumn. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Go to our website to find out more about Langley's talks at ISU, plus hear why he feels the study of villains rather than superheroes is problematic in an exclusive clip at our website, WGLT.org. This is Danny Elfman's theme from the 1989 Batman movie.
Despite the phrase, talk is not cheap, the talk you value on public radio costs money. And to help out, we want you to talk to us. Leave us a message at 438-WGLT. Tell us what you like and why you contribute. Tell us why you can't unplug from WGLT.org and make a case to get everyone to contribute. We want it all. And then we'll use all of your comments to get everyone to give during GLT's upcoming fundraising campaign. Take a deep breath. Get ready to talk after the tone, and then call 309-438-WGLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Laura Kennedy's Animal House. Leah Johnson is more than just the new volleyball coach at Illinois State University. She's learning to juggle life both on and off the court as the mother of a 3-year-old and a 4-month-old, as she tells GLT's Brian Bloodworth.
I'm juggling literally all day long every day, and it's a beautiful thing. Every mom and parent, for that matter, feels this way. You are always thinking about your children, and you are always thinking about your student athletes. And you, to some degree, it just gives you balance that it, when you're with one, you try to always be with them. And so when my kids come to mind, I stop for a second, I make a quick note, and then I get back on track because this is where my attention should be right now. And it's no different when I go home. I try to schedule my recruiting calls in the afternoon or after bedtime hours so that when I'm with my kids, I'm fully present. And I think it just forces us to make good choices and be a bit, put things in front of ourselves and put our kids in front of us, put our student athletes before us. But it takes a lot of purpose and a lot of intentional decision making. And it certainly requires a village. I mean, I couldn't do it without the support of my husband. Our staff has been so welcoming and helping. With my kids, they drop into practice on a pretty regular basis, and then in the community to know that people, are excited to meet my family and welcome my family so that this feels like home right away. So it's pretty awesome.
So your husband knew what he was signing up for when he got involved.
Well, he thinks he does, but yeah, no, he did, and he has been fantastic. He is very much about helping me pursue my goals, and vice versa. We run a very equal household, and so there aren't traditional roles. There are everyone's roles, and it's all hands on deck, and I think that's the best way to do it for us. And he supports me as best he can, and certainly there's times we both compromise. And something has to give, but it's been a really cool thing.
What attracted you to Illinois State?
There were several things, really. You know, I played in the Missouri Valley, played for Missouri State, and when I first started playing, Illinois State was the premier program. It was the team you had to beat if you ever wanted to be anyone. And so I really had this idea of Illinois State being on just a threshold above everyone. And so that has kind of been ingrained in my head. And then, you know, I've watched the program grow. I love how well it's supported. It is so impressive how the administration gets behind the volleyball program here, the rich tradition for women's athletics. So there's so many things that make this such a great place.
And I was going to say, as you said, you come to ISU with the knowledge of the Missouri Valley Conference and the Redbirds program. Was that a benefit?
Absolutely. I think the Missouri Valley is now at a place where people realize what a major volleyball conference it is. But in years past, that wasn't the case. And so I think having the knowledge in my situation, knowing how strong the conference is, allows me to be prepared for how hard you have to work to win in this league.
And you're inheriting a strong team with a number of returnees, so the expectations are obviously high. How do you approach that?
Well, I think about it a lot. It's stressful to some degree, but it's exciting too. You know, I think high expectations when you're an athlete, me being a former athlete, makes you rise to the occasion. And so I think we have a tremendous amount of talent. I think anyone could start any given night, so our depth is very deep. So it allows me a lot of options, allows me to be creative, and that plays to my strengths. So in that sense, I feel like it's a good pairing for me and then for the program.
You took the job in June, which is rather late in terms of the volleyball season. What kind of problems did that pose, or did it?
Well, I think personally, I had a baby in March, end of March, and so I have a four-month-old. I was still on maternity leave when this job came open and was still just kind of getting my bearings in that sense on top of a three-year-old. So personally, I had to kind of reset my mind. I wasn't in the mindset of having to start over, if you will. But this was one of those jobs that you would be crazy to say no to. And that was my first challenge. I think the second challenge is the team knows they should be successful. And they had their head in a certain place, too, when I arrived. And they weren't expecting the late change. And it was a matter of building trust as fast as you can. And I think we all know that establishing trust can take some time, and we had to just go in with an open mind and say, we don't have time to get our feet wet. It has to be blind trust from the beginning. And so that was the biggest obstacle to overcome first, and I feel very good about where we're at there.
I was going to say that the trust issue, how do you do that?
Yeah. No, it's conversations, it's relationships, it's sticking to your word as much as you can. You know, when you say something, you follow through. And you give people the benefit of the doubt when they can't, so they know that you're on their side and that you have their back. And I think just demonstrating those things in the small daily nuances of the way you go about your business, whether it's player interaction, staff interaction, you know, campus interaction.
And it also didn't give you much time to learn the personalities of the players,
right?
Obviously. And how are you going about doing that? Because you didn't recruit any of these players.
I didn't. And, you know, I met with their parents actually before a red and white scrimmage, and I told them, I said, I've only had, you know, 2 weeks and now 3 weeks with this squad, but I would tell you I'd go back and recruit them all again. They have been so impressive in the way they carry themselves, who they are, what they stand for. But it has. I think that's going to be a season-long learning curve. You know, I think as much as they're trying to show their true colors, they're trying to learn mine. And so there's always small hesitancies or pauses when normally you would just jump in. And so we're working through that pretty quickly, and I think quite well, honestly. I've been very pleased with their open-mindedness.
I was going to say, that says a lot for the players, doesn't it?
It sure does. I mean, they're just a quality group. And Leanna and Larry and the administration had told me that's what I was getting when I got here. But to see it firsthand and the way we interact, you know, we have leadership meetings every Monday, and the players have been so supportive and encouraging to tell me the things that they're enjoying, you know, and giving me faith in what I'm doing and vice versa.
And getting back to the personalities of the players, I mean, you obviously have to treat each player different because each player is an individual.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach that, and how do you deal with things like that?
You know, it's funny. There's a couple schools of thought there, really. Some people will say, you know, that equality looks like treating everyone exactly the same. And I really feel like my job is to help each person meet their potential, and therefore our team will be better. So it does take a different approach for every person. And communicating that I do see each person as an individual, and our system and our plan must be the same and uniform, but the way each person needs information, or maybe someone needs a different approach in the weight room, or a different technique or a different set in our offense. It's my job to find those those unique things and make sure we exploit them and we enhance them as much as we can.
This is Brian Bloodworth, and you're listening to Sound Ideas with new Illinois State volleyball coach Leah Johnson. How do you motivate your players and the team as a whole?
There's a few things I like to do. One, I think if they trust you, they're more motivated by your ideas. And so we're trying to build trust every day. But we also compete every day. You know, I was just listening to Brock's back in his press conference, and he said he puts his ones versus ones, twos versus twos. And you don't see that a lot in volleyball, but in our gym you do. So we intermix our players every single day so that, you know, Jalen Keene is hitting against Courtney Pence as much as we can, so that she's having to defend that type of offense. And intermixing with everyone builds trust, but it also builds a buy-in for each other. And when you're bought into the person next to you, you're more motivated, and it makes my job a little easier. So I think that it's a lot of layers there, but they all work together pretty well.
And I understand you're making some changes from what fans are familiar in seeing. Can you tell us about some of those changes and how the players have reacted and adapted?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think one of the biggest changes you'll see is we are trying our best to run a more balanced offense. You know, Jalen Keene obviously carries a lot of weight for us, and she will for all season. But as you become a senior, and everyone in conference knows who you are, everyone in the country knows who you are. So to allow her a little relief and spread the ball a bit more is certainly going to be a positive thing for us. We're also speeding things up, especially to our pin hitters on the outside and the right side. So we're setting our offense a bit faster. Stephanie Jankowicz, a freshman setter, is doing a terrific job with our decision making. You know, I tend to you know, counter flow a bit more or use different options situationally.
You were the head coach at SIU Edwardsville before coming here, and you took that program from the Division II level to the Division I. What were the biggest hardships along the way?
Initially, it was mentality. We had to get in a Division I way of doing things. It's the details. You have to do so many small things really well to compete at the highest level. Whether it's nutrition or the way we go about our strength and conditioning year-round versus seasonal, but also in the gym, just expecting yourself to compete like you would on game day, on practice day. And so that was something we worked on early. And then through the recruiting process, we needed to build depth. You know, great teams have options coming off the bench when they struggle to still be able to compete and be able to challenge their opponents. And so once we got depth in our gym and we were able to compete pretty highly on both sides of the net, you know, we broke in at that time last year to the top 100 in the nation. And so that was how that process played out.
How did that experience help you grow as a coach?
To some degree, I think I came away with more than I left. And you know, you don't want to say that, but it really is true. You learn something from every season, from every player. And I found my philosophy. I really believe in competition. I really believe you have to earn your way every single day, and I want as much data and numbers to show me what my gut is telling me and to challenge my gut. And I think it makes my instincts better. So those are things. I also kind of learned how I want to nurture leadership and develop players as people and what that looks like. And it's just a lot of conversations. A lot of conversations. You can never talk enough.
Having been at SIU Edwardsville, also obviously it had to help you a little bit in your recruiting of future classes here, mm-hmm. because you've seen a lot of players probably, but maybe
Absolutely. If
you at SIU Edwardsville, you didn't feel like maybe you could attract them,
yep.
the same type of player you can here.
Yeah, I think the approach is different. So we eventually got into a lot of great conversations with some high level players, but getting the yes was very difficult. And that was where my mentality was last summer. How do I get the yes now? We were at a great place there, and the success was helping that. Coming to Illinois State, I think the university itself gets some interest beyond the volleyball program. And so I'm able to get in those conversations and get those people interested and bought into our program, and now the university helps draw the final decision. And so I'm going to work harder to play those two together to see if we can't steal some players from the Big Ten. And steal some players from the SEC. Like, that's the level of volleyball we're playing in the Missouri Valley.
What are the current trends in volleyball? I mean, you know, What kind of changes do you see on the horizon, or is the game in a good place?
Yeah. It is the highest level and fastest pace I've ever seen it. I think there's, because it's so high level and it's so fast paced, it's moving toward a replay system because your eye can't hardly keep up. The athleticism on the volleyball court is insane. If you've only watched, you know, your junior high cousin play volleyball, you have no idea what you're missing. It's very intense and it's very intimate, the volleyball setting. So I think the replay system's adding a lot of value to keep things honest and keep the game fair and equal. There's a lot of parity in volleyball because most programs across the country are well supported. It's usually a top sport in their respective schools, so players have more options. It's the number one sport in high school right now in women's sports outside of track, team sport. So there is competition, the depth is deeper, the talent pool is deeper, therefore the universities are deeper in their programs. I think that is a great place for Illinois State, for us to position ourselves, because we're in Illinois, we have this growing hotbed of talent, and we're in a school that attracts great people. So it's pretty exciting. Really cool.
Is the team ahead of where you'd hoped, about where you thought, or did you have any expectations?
Mm-hmm. That's a fair question, and I think I have to go with the latter. I mean, I had expectations that we would be good. I didn't know where we'd be right away because I knew I was going to introduce some things that were different. They were going to have to earn their starting spots differently. That was going to add stress early that they'd have to work through. So to some degree, I knew it could have a huge positive effect, but I wasn't sure it'd be this fast. And the way we competed against number 14 Florida State and had them on the ropes, I mean, it was 24-24 in set four for us to win. And unfortunately, we didn't get the break we wanted. But that was a testament, I think, to what we implemented and how quickly they adhered.
Well, good luck to you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the time, and thanks to the listeners.
GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth talked with ISU volleyball coach Leah Johnson. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. You're already in a relationship with GLT, so let's make it Facebook official. Follow GLT on Facebook and Twitter for the latest news, interviews, music, and more all day long and through the weekend. You'll join a community of GLT fans eager to talk about the day's news and what it means for Central Illinois. So, like our page at facebook.com/WGLTFM and follow us on Twitter at WGLTNews. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Reading is fundamental and even more fun if you have a canine pal close by listening in. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more on a program that has dogs helping kids with literacy on this edition of Animal House.
On a cool Saturday morning at Normal Public Library, 9-year-old Cooper Rutledge has a book all picked out. Why the Sea is Salty, A Tale from Korea.
Retold by Rosie Dickens, illustrated by Sarah Rojo.
But this book isn't just for Cooper. He aims to share it, reading aloud to an audience of one.
Long ago, the sea wasn't salty. It is like it is today. Once, it tasted sweet.
An audience with sympathetic eyes, eager ears, and a glossy golden coat.
This millstone belonged to a great king. Most millstones are used for making
Cooper
flowers.
Is taking but part in Pages and Paws, a monthly program at the Normal Public Library that allows youngsters to practice their reading skills with a therapy dog companion. The program was established a little over a year ago. Julia Martin is the library's tech and programming librarian for the Children's Department. And she says the purpose of this program is to give the kids a chance to practice their reading skills in a non-judgmental environment.
When they're reading to a dog isn't judging them. It's not correcting them or, you know, eagerly waiting for it. It's just patiently waiting for them to read the words and just tell the story. It also adds a comfort level to them that they may not get when they're reading to adults or other, even their peers.
So far, Martin says the reaction has been enthusiastic. Kids, books, and dogs just make a great combination. And Martin says the dogs aren't just any canines. They're specially trained, certified therapy dogs.
They do have to go through an observation process, which I'm actually going through with one of my dogs right now. So yeah, it consists of a test where they have to be approached by a stranger, they have to walk past another dog calmly, things like that. Then they have to go, we've been going to nursing homes and they see how they interact with people, how they interact with all the hustle and bustle. So they're just very calm and have been taught and been observed to be calm consistently. As well as the insurance, all of our dogs are certified through Therapy Dogs Incorporated. They do offer insurance to all of their therapy dogs, which helps us on our end.
One of the therapy dog handlers at Pages and Paws is Kathy Yelton.
And my other part of the team is Harley. He is my 9-year-old golden retriever who we've been certified therapy dog team for 6 years. He was only 3 when we started. He's always just been an extremely mellow and caring dog, and I started through just obedience training and started him as puppy and went all the way up, and we got our canine good citizen. And then it was kind of like, what do I do next? And somebody at the dog training club at Town and Country Kennel Club said, you know, he would be a great therapy dog. And I didn't really know what that meant. So I kind of looked into it, and basically to become certified for therapy dog, you have to go to visits at nursing homes and take tests and all these other things. And our first visit at the nursing home, we'd never been before, and he walked right up to this man sitting off by himself in a wheelchair, and he just laid his head right in the man's lap. And I was at the end of my little 4-foot leash feeling like I was intruding. And after a couple minutes, the man looked at me and he said, I really like him. And I said, he really likes you. And that's kind of my big eye-opening moment, you know, a light bulb went off saying, this is what we were meant to do.
Librarian Julia Martin says it's not just the kids' reading skills that improve.
The added benefits beyond reading extend to comfort levels with dogs, being around new people. The way we've got it set up is they come in the room and they're in there with the dog and the therapy dog handler. So, you know, it gives them a little bit of independence. We've had several kids who aren't necessarily dog people who come and do this and end up loving it. So I think it definitely adds to some comfort and ability to be in new situations as well.
Dog lover Abby Wheeler is a longtime library goer, first-time Pages and Paws participant.
I'm not nervous. I'm excited because I love dogs and I can't wait to see Harley.
Why do you particularly want to read to Harley?
Because Harley's a golden retriever and they're my favorite dogs.
What are you bringing today to read with Harley?
The Land of Stories, The Wishing Spell.
So is that a really good book? What's that about?
It's about Alex and Connor who live in the regular world and get sucked up in a book, and now they're in the Land of Stories.
As for Cooper Rutledge, he's an old hand at this.
Because I really like dogs. I have a dog at home, and he's really nice, even though he's like 87 in dog years.
So are you somebody who likes to read a lot? Or
yes.
Did you like to read a lot before you started reading to the dogs, or did the dogs really make a difference for you?
I like to read a lot before I started reading to the dogs, and I decided maybe it would be a good chance to have some fun.
So what did you bring with you today to read?
I brought a book of Eric Carle's fables and a folk tale of Why the Sea is Salty.
Cooper's mom, Kelly, has noticed an improvement in Cooper's reading. And more.
Being here and reading with the dogs, reading in front of other people gives him even more confidence, and then he goes to school and other places and he's not nervous about talking or reading in front of other people.
Librarian Julia Martin says it's not just the kids that benefit. The therapy dog handlers find that this is a unique way to give back.
It's a great way to get out in the community and really make a difference. I mean, people just light up when you come, and it's great just to be able to do that and spend some time doing that for the community.
Martin hopes to continue the Pages and Paws program at the Normal Public Library. Its increasing popularity means participants will need to sign up early to get a slot to read to a friendly canine who's all ears and all fur. If you've got a hankering to relate a tale to an eager canine, consider the Animal House Pet of the Week. It's Carlton. This 6-year-old boxer enjoys being with people, especially those who enjoy reading aloud from the classics. Dickens, Shakespeare, and the adventures of Captain Underpants. Carlton also enjoys listening to the Harry Potter books al fresco or while riding around in the company of his people. You can find Carlton at the Humane Society of Central Illinois. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of the Pages and Paws program in action at the Normal Public Library at our website, wglt.org. This is WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Laura Kennedy, Ryan Denham, and Brian Bloodworth. That's at WGLT.org. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sound Ideas is made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.